All right, welcome back. Now we are switching our focus over to the energy sector as promised, as we are chatting with our good friend Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Dan, as we always do, we cover more of the macro environment for oil and natural gas, and then move into some of the stocks that you see setting up well and how you're trading some of these stocks. So let's start off with oil, because oil has been on a pretty nice run as we're recording this. Early on in the day on Wednesday, the oil price has pulled back just under that $80 a barrel level, but it recently touched levels that we hadn't seen since last April. Again, this bullish but still kind of trading range that oil is trading in, at least it's more near the top of the range currently. Dan, what's been some of the drivers, do you think, that has resulted in that more bullish, that stronger oil price recently?
Well, everybody's starting to see that demand for oil-based products, especially transportation fuels, exceeds supply. We're draining above-ground inventories by probably about 2 million barrels a day right now, here in the beginning of August, and it's likely to go to 3 million barrels a day where demand exceeds supply. And so we're supplies above ground are already way below where they were pre-COVID. We're about 250 million barrels in storage above ground than we were pre-COVID, and we're demand is pretty much back to pre-COVID, if not even higher, and expected to continue to rise. Both IEA, EIA are still saying oil-based products are demand is going to be high. And so as U.S. and OECD petroleum inventories fall, you at some point have to start rationing these fuels by price. So before you have to, you know, resort to physical rationing, like you can only, you know, fill up, get gasoline 2 or 3 days a week or something, which we had back in the 70s, they'll do it just by price. So it discourages people. They start, you know, watching where they drive more, and that'll help a little bit. But pretty much it's inelastic. I mean, people complain about high gasoline prices, but at the end of the day, we still have to go to work and we still want to go on vacation and stuff. And it's really not that high a percentage of our total spending anyway, but it's just something that everybody watches the gasoline price intently. But then, you know, on the natural gas side, I think we do have a situation with the storage level being too high that I think natural gas prices are going to struggle to get back to $3.
Well, Dan, just to that point, you know, when you look at, and we were talking about this before we started recording today, when you look at oil, it's really a global market. When you look at nat gas, it's much more of a regional market. But we also were discussing, it's really hard to nail down what's moving these markets, because is it the macroeconomic backdrop with the U.S. and what we're doing? Is it with the currencies in the individual countries? Is it the actual supply-demand factors? Is it OPEC? What do you think the prime mover actually is in these markets? Because it's very complex.
Yeah, today, which is, you know, we're recording this on August 2nd, Fitch downgraded U.S. credit rating, and that's got everybody freaking out. So I think that's the overall market, because the companies themselves, the second quarter results are going to be the low point for the year, especially for the companies that produce a lot of natural gas, because natural gas got down to like $2 for a long time. And several of the predominantly gas companies that I follow actually reported losses. But, you know, even if gas gets back and, you know, stays over between $2.50 and $3 before it really starts to take off, which I think it will, when we get midway through 2024, I think natural gas prices will start to rise on a consistent basis. But anyway, you know, the second half looks really good for these companies. I mean, I'm getting second quarter reports, and I'm getting fresh guidance from all the companies that I follow, which is like almost too many. I'm trying to follow like 40 companies at this point in the schedule. I'm overwhelmed by new data. So I've been updating a lot of forecast models, but they're going to be in good shape. They're all trading at, you know, like PE ratios of 5 or 6. And some of these stocks are trading at like 2.5 times cash flow, which is insane.
What about the OPEC considerations, though? Is there anything you're watching on the OPEC or OPEC plus landscape that could move prices, at least in the short term?
Well, with U.S. oil production flatlining, we actually, at the current active rig count, there's no way U.S. production can continue to grow oil production. In fact, it's been stuck at about 12.3 million. And pre-COVID, we were at about 12.9 million barrels a day, and now we're at 12.3, and it looks like we're going to stay there. I mean, there's no way. The active rig count has dropped because the private companies have dropped a lot of their rigs. The public companies are pretty much, you know, keeping their drilling activity fairly level, but the private companies cannot carry a bunch of inventory, and they drilled up all their tier one inventory, so they don't have much left to go. But the only basin that's really got upside is the Permian Basin now. So I don't know. I just see the global market getting tighter and tighter. The Saudi Arabia situation, they are in control of the price. There's no doubt about it. If they want to take the oil price to 100, they can do it. They just got to hold their current production levels. And I think it was reported this morning that OPEC pumped like 900,000 barrels a day less in July than they pumped in June. So they're definitely sticking with their plans. And the big macro news, I think, that is very bullish for oil prices is that Russia exports, oil exports are now starting to fall. Now, you know, a lot of the service companies pulled out of Russia. And so I just think they're going to have problems. They're going to have problems this winter, and it's not going to be voluntary. I think they're just going to be forced to have lower oil production because of problems at the well sites. So we'll see. But the only negative I've seen, I know China was buying as much of that cheap oil from Russia as they could possibly get. They have no fear of our sanctions or anything. So they're buying all that cheap oil. So is India. And they've built up their SPR. While we're draining our strategic petroleum reserve, China has built up their strategic petroleum reserve. And I think they have, you know, several, you know, 100 billion or whatever barrels more than they need. So they could start draining their SPR to try to keep a lid on oil prices. But I don't really think China is going to be shipping us any oil anytime soon.
Yeah, Dan, that seems unlikely, but you never know in these wild trade agreements. Well, you mentioned something there I want to touch on, and that is the reduction in drilling, and that the Permian is really only the growth basin, some of the other basins in decline. What does that mean overall? I guess because you really focus on U.S. markets and basins and companies. What does that mean for U.S. production if the drilling is so much lower for both private companies or just steady with the public companies? And we've seen other articles on this. We've had other people mention this before, that this kind of does not bode well for the future as far as it should be a declining production story in the U.S. unless something changes. Could they change and start drilling more, or is there just not the availability of these basins to keep drilling them any further?
Well, eventually you run out of tier one acreage in all your basins. I mean, the shale basins are no different than all other oil fields. At some point in time, you've drilled up all the good acreage, and you can't complete enough, you know, tier two, tier three wells to offset the decline of the hundreds of thousands of these high decline rate shale wells. Because these horizontal wells come on really, really strong. They pay out quickly, but they decline, you know, they decline, and you have to keep drilling more and more wells just to hold production flat. That doesn't mean that these companies that are in the Bakken or in the Eagle Ford that have good acreage, they're going to be fine. And there's upside in those companies. In fact, there's quite a bit of upside, I think, if oil prices continue to go higher. But, you know, eventually the U.S., this, you know, we enjoyed this big spurt. You know, our conventional production is down to about under 4 million barrels a day. So all of the difference between 4 million barrels a day and 12 million barrels a day, that's all from shale. So the shale miracle isn't going to last forever. You run out of all the good stuff. So I don't know, but I the companies themselves, they used last year and their discipline to shore up their balance sheets. I mean, heading into 2023, these companies have the strongest balance sheets. They don't have any debt problems, and they're really, really in good shape financially. And most of them that I follow are generating free cash flow. So they are covering all of their drilling expenses, keeping production flat or growing it a little bit. And they're having free cash flow. They're paying out its dividend. They're buying back their stock. And all that is a recipe for higher share prices.
All right, Dan, we're out of time for this segment on the radio. But we're going to continue our discussion next segment. So everyone, stick around.
So something that was a big boom for U.S. production was that whole shale development and fracking that all of a sudden saw a spike in U.S. production. Since companies are generating more money, since they are still looking for growth to a certain extent, is there anything new? Are companies doing anything new to open up new fields, to produce more? Anything that you're seeing on the corporate side that is showing that, you know what, maybe there's some innovation in U.S.?
Well, the one thing that I'm seeing, one example I'll give you, it's a small company called Colibri Global Energy. Actually, they trade on Canadian Exchange first, and then they're in the pink sheets in the U.S. But they worked with Schlumberger to come up with a new way to complete wells, a new recipe, let's say, with a, you know, targeted fracks, using different kind of sands, different kind of fluids in their completion. And they're completing these wells in what's called the Caney Formation. All their production is in central Oklahoma in the Scoop Play, which is heavily weighted to oil. And they're getting tremendous results from this new completion method. You know, here is a zone that was previously considered marginal at best, and these wells are coming on well above, you know, previous wells completed in that zone. And, you know, paying out in less than a year, and they've got, you know, 100 locations. So, yeah, you know, the oil service companies are constantly looking at ways to do things differently that might help. And then, it does. There's going to be stuff. But as far as the well's length, I mean, how far can you go? I mean, the average lateral is now 8,000 or 10,000 feet. So they drill down, you know, a mile or two, and then they drill sideways for 8,000, 10,000. I listened to Comstock yesterday, and their average length on their new wells is like 11,000 feet. So you're at like two miles on your horizontal. So how far can you really go out? And, you know, and that's why is that we need higher oil prices, because higher oil prices will give them the money to try new things and maybe do recompletions of older wells and stuff like that. So we got a long way to go. I mean, I don't see U.S. oil production like going on serious decline, but I think all this view that it's going to be continuously, we can add, you know, we can just run out there and add 2 million barrels a day year after year, that period's already over. That's done. And we're going to need, based on the forecast of demand forecast that this is IEA, not my forecast, but IEA, EIE for next year, global demand's going to go to 104 million, 105 million barrels a day. We're going to need every barrel of OPEC spare capacity, and we're going to have to start opening up the Gulf of Mexico. This war on fossil fuels that Biden, you know, is stuck in, I guess, that's got to stop. We've got to start working together. U.S. needs to start working better with Canada, and we just need a more realistic, common sense energy policy.
Well, Dan, we can pray for common sense from policymakers, but in the meantime, we're going to have to deal with the market. And
we
sounds like
deal with the real world. Right?
Deal with the real. And it sounds like in these kind of environment that it could be something similar to coal, where everybody was against coal, but the price of coal just kept going higher and higher, because the reality is people weren't ready to wean themselves off it, and they still aren't. So same thing with fossil fuels. If there continues to be policy pressure, that could just end up spiking the price even higher, because the demand is growing, not shrinking. And in that kind of an environment, there's certain companies that are just keeping the status quo. As you mentioned, they paid off their debt, they're buying back shares, they're paying nice dividends, they're rolling right along. But there's other companies, maybe a little smaller or mid-sized, that are really scrappier. They're looking for growth. They're looking to really grow their operations. Which companies really stand out to you as companies on the growth wedge?
Well, I just published a report on Crescent Point, one of your Canadian companies. And, you know, they closed a really nice strategic acquisition. I can't think of the name of it now, but they look really good. When you think about these acquisitions that are just being closed now, they were negotiated at a much lower oil price. And the good thing about Crescent Point is, of the properties they acquired, they've completed, you know, half a dozen wells or so on those new assets, and they're doing much better than what the previous operator had. So they're very excited about it. It looks really good. And some of the biggest gains I've ever had on companies is when the market underestimates what this acquisition will do. Not only does it just add their current production, but you get your assets that probably were being held by a company that didn't have the technical teams as good as somebody like a Crescent Point. And so when those assets get taken over, they can have a stair step. And not only did they get this production at a good price, but they get all this drilling inventory that they can make wells that are much better than the previous operator. And I like that kind of situation. Another Canadian, InPlay Oil, man, they were able to make some acquisitions in 2020, you know, when we were in the heart of COVID and some of these operators were forced to sell these assets at way below market value. They were able to pick up some properties and man, they got a lot of running room too. And they're almost debt free. So I focus on the balance sheet, make sure these guys got the capital to have the money to complete their strategy and their drilling programs and stuff like that. But I'm looking for undervalued companies trading at very low multiples of cash flow. And if you can find them before the Wall Street gang figures it out, that's where your biggest gains come from.
Do you think there's any chance of a consolidation happening in the sector too, Dan, where some of the bigger guys start to take out some of these smaller ones or the ones that maybe haven't gotten the bounce in share price?
Well, what I've been seeing is the public companies are taking out some of the private companies because the private companies, you know, they run out of money. They just, you know, this is a big money game and they'll put together a drilling partnership, but they can't keep going back to their partners and saying, hey, we need more money. We need more money. You can't keep doing that. So they'll spend their money. They'll prove up these assets and then they'll sell them to a public company that now has the capital and technical teams to take it to the next level. And so I've seen a lot of that. That's Earthstone and I'm still extremely high on Earthstone. One of the things you'll see too is the Wall Street gang, when these public companies take over a private company, because the private companies don't have to file, you know, they're not audited and they don't have, you know, third party engineers reviewing their stuff all the time. So they're very cautious. The analysts are very cautious on what value they give to those companies. But, you know, if you trust the management team, like I've known the Earthstone guys for 20 years and I know they know what they're doing. And so, I'm excited about that one. I'll tell you another one that I just did a report on is Matador Resources, and they remained very aggressive. They didn't really pull back their drilling program during COVID. And, you know, at that time, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, they were really being criticized by that. But now, that company's been averaging 20% production growth year after year after year. They're now up to about 130 or 40,000 barrels a day. And boy, they really look good. So that symbol is MTDR, if you want to look at that. And if any of your listeners, if they want to contact me and ask me about some of these companies we talk about, I can send them a report on them.
Appreciate you making that offer, Dan. And I guess another thing that we've had some emails about, and we've actually had a handful of analysts we brought on the show discuss, is the oil services sector. Not so much the drilling for the reasons we outlined earlier, but there's a lot of pipeline companies that are growing. There's other companies that augment or support the oil and gas industry. Any of those companies catching your eye?
Yeah, there's a little kind of a niche company that I like, and it's Solaris Oilfield Infrastructure. Their symbol is SOI. These guys, somebody posted a comment about they just invented the better mousetrap. They have got the equipment that is used to complete wells that handles the frac sand. They're not a frac sand company. What they do is they have this equipment that handles and pumps the frac sand into the wells, and it reduces the cost for the company that's completing those wells. And again, they're like debt free. They pay a really nice dividend. I think they're headed for a lot of upside. The stock originally a couple of years ago, pre-COVID, got up into the mid-20s, and now it's like $10 a share, and they pay like a 5 or 6% dividend. And based on my forecast, they should be increasing their dividend next year.
Dan, when you're looking at some of these production companies, is there a certain multiple that you put on production, cash flow, or any other metric when we do go through the financial statements that you use as kind of a ballpark guide to see if a stock is undervalued? For all these people that are generally new to the sector, they're looking at these reports saying, this thing is making money, but what's kind of a baseline valuation that I could expect?
Well, the thing to remember about an upstream company, any upstream company can just stop drilling and produce out their current wells and generate a whole bunch of cash flow. So some people say, oh, I only want to own companies that have free cash flow. Well, the problem is, you know, just drop all your rigs and just produce well, you'll have a ton of free cash flow. So that's not the only thing. So you got to look at strength of balance sheet. You got to look at what I call running room. Does the company have high quality development drilling inventory? Comstock's a perfect example. Even though the gas price, this is a pure gasser, 90% of their production is gas. And right now I'm not recommending it because I think in the short term gas price is going to be low. But they hold a massive amount of super high quality tier one acreage in the Haynesville play. And then they've extended the play over into Texas. It's primarily a Louisiana play, but they've found the trend over in East Texas, and they're completing some massive wells. And based on their guidance, they have 25 years of high quality drilling inventory. That's massive. So, you know, look at the drilling inventory, look what they've got. Another one is Diamondback Energy, FANG, F-A-N-G is their symbol. And Diamondback thinks their stock is grossly undervalued. They've put $4 billion into a fund to buy back their own stock. So they're going to significantly reducing the outstanding shares. And again, you know, you have a company that's growing production and proven reserves. You have a company reducing their share count. They already have a super high quality balance sheet. They have no debt problems, and they have a ton of high quality running room in the Permian Basin. Related to that company, they spun off a lot of their minerals into a company called Viper. And Viper announced the other day that they're going to convert from a partnership to a C corp. They already elected to be taxed as a C corp. But what this does, when they become a C corp, there's a lot more hedge funds that can buy them, because some hedge funds, some, you know, mutual funds, they cannot invest in partnerships. They can only invest in C corps. So that'll draw a lot of attention to that company. And it's heavily weighted to oil, super strong balance sheet. And again, it pays out like 65% of its free cash flow is distributed as quarterly dividends. So it looks really good to me. And you mentioned, you know, some of the service companies, and I really do like all the pipeline companies. You know, they're not really directly exposed to commodity prices. They get paid for moving the product, storing it, you know, maybe processing it to some extent, but they get paid by the volumes. And unless you believe the U.S. is going to go into a deep recession, we're going to need these midstream companies and especially the pipeline companies to move these products around.
Well, Dan, you've already mentioned Nat Gas and that you're not that positive on it, but we still get a lot of people animated by the Nat Gas plays, trying to be contrarians and pick the bottom on them. You've written to your subscribers, though, and we've talked about this, too, just that you don't think that the recovery in Nat Gas is going to happen quick enough. So what does that mean for Nat Gas companies? You already mentioned Comstock, but there's other gassers out there. Should people just hold off till next year on acquiring those and focus on oil, or how are you managing that with your subscribers?
Well, you have to. I'm very bullish long term. Very bullish. I believe that by the end of 2024, the right price for gas is going to go over $5. I truly believe that. I mean, in Europe today, it's $9. In Asia, it's $11. So as we gain more access to the international market, that'll pull up the gas price in the U.S. But I think in the short term, I think what a lot of it's a seasonal trade. You see a lot of people move money into the gas as we approach winter, and you're going to get that, you know, anyway. And the gas price probably will drift up to get to three, at least, I hope, by mid-November when the official winter starts mid-November. But unless we have a cold start to winter, I just think it's going to be very difficult for gas to get to where the strip is. I mean, if you go to the NYMEX strip prices for Henry Hub, you're going to see a lot of months like, you know, December through March, April of next year, every month's price is $3.25 to $3.50. And I think people believe that the real world is going to, you know, the front month is going to roll up to those prices when we get into December. Well, what if it doesn't? If I was running these gas companies, I'd be hedging as much gas as I could for December through March and April at the current strip. I'd try to lock those prices in today, but you know, it's up to them to do it. They're afraid they miss, but you can also have a lot of exposure by, you know, some of these companies that get today, most of their revenues, from oil do have a lot of gas production. I mean, EOG is a great example. They have a ton of gas production, but they get most of their revenues. Ovintiv, that used to be in Canada, they have a lot of gas production, but you know, they're doing really well based on their oil production too. So, you know, there's different ways to play it. I'm down on Comstock short term because it's a 99% of their production is gas, dry gas. They don't even produce many NGLs.
So, Dan, if you're bullish long-term on these natural gas or the natural gas sector and some of the stocks, are there any stocks that are paying a high dividend? So, at least if you invested now, maybe the share price doesn't go anywhere, but you still get paid to wait.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One, for example, is Coterra. Coterra Energy is heavily weighted to gas, but it pays a nice fixed plus variable dividend, which is kind of low right now because the variable part of it's kind of low. But Pioneer Natural Resources pays a really nice dividend. Diamondback, they stopped paying their variable dividend. They're just going to be paying their base dividend. They moved the money over to their share buyback program. I like Civitas. That's C-I-V-I is a symbol. And it's a DJ Basin, Colorado company is where they get most of their production. Pays a really nice dividend. So that's a good one. And then I think the mineral companies, I really like all four of the mineral companies that are in our high yield income portfolio. That's Blackstone, which is the most weighted, most exposed to gas, but they've got over half of their gas production for the rest of this year hedged at 515. So they're getting, you know, really large cash settlements on their hedges every month. And then there's Kimball Royalty Partners, KRP, had a really good quarter. They just announced their quarter yesterday. STR and Viper, STR and Venom, VNOM. Those are two mineral companies that I like that pay really nice dividends, and they're more heavily weighted to oil. But they, I mean, they have gas. I mean, maybe 25-30% of their production's gas. So if the gas does come back, it'll be even more a real plus for these guys.
All right, Dan. We'll wrap it up here. Always great hearing from you. And I know our listeners really enjoy the stock coverage as well, the wide range of stocks that you cover. So depending on your portfolio strategy, well, Dan has some stocks in the oil and natural gas sector that could fit your portfolio. So Dan, again, thank you very much for your time on this weekend show. Everyone, thanks for tuning in on the weekend show. We're going to be back with you next week. Yes, we are in summer. We've all seen this broad kind of sell-off in a wide range of sectors. Who knows? Hopefully money will rotate back in, but I think just covering some of the stocks and seeing what's a potential out there when these markets do turn again is always valuable for portfolios. So Dan, everybody, thanks for tuning in this weekend. We'll be back with you next week. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.